Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to talk with USU Professor Tammy Proctor and several students in her sports history class about a project they're calling Sliding Into History, the legacy of USU's women's softball champions 1980 to 1981. Class is working on the history of the 1980 and 81 national champion USU softball teams. They've been considering that history in relation to some of the changes taking place these days in women's sports. We're going to talk with Tammy Proctor, USU Distinguished Professor of History, along with her students Claire Rice, Ethan Jepson, Ethan Thompson, and Cecil Wilkinson. So let's meet these folks. Let's start with Claire Rice. Claire, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me, what's your major, and why did you take a sports history class?
So I'm an English teaching major with a history minor. And I grew up just doing sports all of the time. I love women's basketball. I'm a big fan of Caitlin Clark and all of those girls. So I just wanted to kind of learn more about the history of sports.
Yeah. Did you play sports in high school?
I did, just for a little bit. I played club volleyball for a while, and I did some club basketball as well.
I definitely watched, I'm guessing you watched the Final Four, women's Final Four.
Yeah, I did. It was fantastic. It was a good competition.
Yeah. Yeah, wonderful. Let me turn to Ethan Thompson.
Yes, thank you.
Same question. What's your major, and why are you taking the sports history class?
I'm a history major with a double minor in religious studies and sociology. And the reason I took sports history is, growing up, I've always had an interest in history or sports as well. And I've just loved watching them, loved playing them. Watching them on the TV ever since I can remember. And so what better way to get involved than have a history and a sports class together?
Yeah,
so
great. Great.
It's been interesting.
Yeah, so wonderful. Well, thanks for coming on the program. Cecil Wilkinson, is it Cecil or Cecil?
It's Cecil.
Cecil. Thank you. Cecil Wilkinson, same to you. What's your major, and why did you take this class?
So my major is history, and my minor is folklore. But the reason why I took this class is because I wanted to see how sports ran other people's lives. Coming from one of seven children and being very involved with sports at a young age, I've always just wondered how sports involve with other people and how it looks at a broader term. So when I saw the class, I had to take it.
Yeah, wonderful. So Claire mentioned the Women's Final Four. I understand you won the pool.
I did. It was by pure luck, honestly. I did that by random. I looked at the stats, and I said, this is a good team, this is a good team, and this is a good team.
Yeah. So so it wasn't totally by random.
You looked at the stats. I mean, I looked at the stats. So one can do.
But and you had South Carolina winning in the end, I guess.
I believe so.
Yeah, yeah. Well, very good. So Ethan Jepson, what's your major, and why did you take this class?
Hi, thank you. I am a history education major with a minor in film studies, and I, excuse me, sorry, I decided to just take the course just because I also, just like everyone else, has been playing sports for a long time. I've been doing dance since I was, like, able to walk, basically. So I just took the class because I was like, I love sports, I love history, why not do something that involves both?
Yeah, so. Yeah, wonderful. Thank you. So Tammy Proctor. Folks at UPR and UPR will note Tam Proctor for Eating the Past, a wonderful, wonderful program that you're co-hosting. So this is, I understand, the third year of this particular class.
Yeah, the class started in 2022, and each year we've taken on a different public history project related to women's sports. And the origin of that idea really came out of the Title IX 50th anniversary and some conversations with the library about how to put together some kind of an exhibit on Title IX. And we realized that many of the records had not been preserved in a way that they were easily accessible. So we thought, oh, let's look into this. And then now that, you know, 3 years on, we've gotten deeper into it, there's still a lot to do.
So first year was volleyball.
Yeah, volleyball, which was the first women's national champion team in 1978. And then last year was basketball, which had kind of an interesting rise and fall story because it was eliminated at USU for many years, actually, between the late 80s and the early 2000s. And then this year's softball, the other two national teams.
Yeah. So what's the end result? What do you hope to produce from this class?
Well, we've been debating this. I'm kind of looking at the students because we're like, oh, what do we have time to actually do? But we'll give a presentation next week, a public presentation. We have been doing some oral histories, which will be on the library website. And then I think we've hit upon the idea of doing a library guide, which is kind of a publicly accessible guide to some of the materials. The ultimate project next fall in conjunction with the library is to do a physical exhibit on the national teams.
Mm, yeah.
So we'll have that hopefully for homecoming next
year. Right. So Title IX, I imagine, pervades all of this, right? Early 1980. When did women's softball start?
Well,
at USU.
Anybody want to take that one?
I could take it. So women's softball started usually around the intramurals. It longed back. For example, we went to the sports archive, like the special archives in Utah State's library, and we found sources dating back not only into Utah State's history of the 1950s or to the 1960s, early into the 1970s, but they were all amateurs and intramural leagues. They weren't really professional leagues or anything like that, and so it was very interesting to see how it was just started up as a pickup game and then turned into a very professional athletics team, which is very fun to see. It's super easy and captivating when you just get rolling. So,
anybody else want to mention something found in the archives?
Yeah, sorry. So my entire point of doing this, my big focus was focusing on the history of Utah State and its relationship with softball. So I found a ton of super interesting stuff involving the intramurals and professional teams and everything like that. And so, it was a very, very interesting relationship. Cecil said it started in around the 50s, 60s. I think the first intramurals were started in 1932 was the first time that it was ever mentioned in any of the student life papers or anything regarding any intramurals or anything like that. And from there, it's just grown and grown and grown until it kind of dwindled down in the early 2000s. But it was really, really interesting to kind of see that relation and everything, especially mm-hmm. with the women's softball teams.
Yeah. So this is the student paper. I guess you're diving into all kinds of things, including the student paper, right? Anything interesting to stand? I imagine you're looking through for softball, you're probably finding other things as well.
Yeah, and I think one thing that's interesting, and I don't know, maybe Claire can talk about this, is that there's a relationship between baseball and softball. So some of the women are playing baseball, some are playing softball. They call the games different things. I don't know if you want to talk about that a little.
Yeah, I can talk about that. So that was my portion of the bigger essay that the class put together, and I had the opportunity to research women in baseball, which is really interesting because it goes back many, many years that women were involved in baseball. There's different names for it. There was kiddie ball, softball, ball and stick, lots of different terms. Some of it came from England, talking about cricket and those sort of things. There's a lot of influences of baseball and softball. And many people think that softball came from baseball, and that is true. However, there are certain differences between both of them. We also learn a little bit just from me looking into more of that history as we learn a little bit more about throughout the years, the women's involvement professionally and on an amateur level with baseball and softball. We learned I learned about the All-American women's baseball team. It's kind of a famous thing because of the movie A League of Their Own mm-hmm. with Tom Hanks and all mm-hmm. of that. I researched more into that, and they kind of did an in-between between softball and baseball. They made the ball smaller from a softball but larger than a baseball. But we also see this sort of period during early 1900s, late 1800s, where there's women who are suffragettes playing baseball to be more radical and wearing bloomers. And there was a photograph I found in the digital archive. I don't know too much about it at Utah State, but there was a photo of a couple of women and a team playing baseball, and I thought that was super interesting. But they're all dressed in their Victorian dresses and looking really cool and stuff playing baseball, and I was like, wow, I cannot play baseball in a dress. But I don't know, just the relationship between both of them, I feel like softball should get, you know, should have more praise because it is a hard sport. It's really difficult to play when you're out there. I've played it myself, and it shouldn't be like too compared to baseball because they are different. So, Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like historically, at least at some points, it was kind of a protest or a little rebellious for a woman to play baseball.
Definitely. Yeah. And then throughout the years, you know, it just kind of became there was a softball league created and then, you know, baseball league, and then they went back to a softball league. So throughout the years, definitely.
Yeah.
It's rebellious.
Yeah.
We've just done a couple of oral histories with players here from 1980 and 81. And one thing I found kind of intriguing is that both of them started their careers as baseball players kids because they didn't have softball teams to play on. So Jane Worthington and Robin Petrini that we interviewed came up through Little League and baseball leagues and at some point transitioned to softball so that they could play in college. And that that relationship I thought was really interesting.
So if it was open to them, they might have wanted to play on the baseball team when they got to college, or
maybe
were they okay with going to softball?
I think they were okay with it. Robin Petrini mentioned that she's 5'3", and that she thought as a smaller player, softball was something
it was more for her.
More for her.
Yeah.
Yeah. She also said it was harder to hit in softball than in baseball.
Really?
Yeah. Do you remember why, Claire, what she said about the pitching?
Yeah, so the pitching is underhand, right? And when you're at the base batting, in like baseball, when they throw overhand, you can see the ball coming at you. But with softball, it's coming underneath you, and you're not really like seeing it come like straight on. So that's kind of what she talked about was, you know, the difficulty of it.
She said they kind of hide it between, you know, behind their leg when they're throwing it. And so you have to watch for it. And she also said that some pitches perform differently if they're thrown in baseball style versus softball style. So that was, I thought, really interesting.
Also, the distance between the pitcher and the batter have changed throughout the years. Back then, they said it was 3 feet closer. But now the women play like a little bit further than that. So,
Well, that's a whole art. That underhanded pitch it comes at you pretty fast, right?
Yeah.
And as you're telling me, it's harder to what would you say, detect the ball, the spin, harder to see the ball.
Yeah,
even though it's
definitely
a bigger ball.
Yeah.
Well, and they did, both of them talked about how in their era of playing, the pitchers were key. And I don't know if Ethan wants to say anything about Mary Lou Ram, but she was their star All-American pitcher in both years that they won. And both of them credit her with really making the team successful. So I don't know if you want to say anything about her.
Yeah, totally. So when I was doing my research for the project, it was about Utah State celebrities, women's softball celebrities, and Mary Lou Ram was one of the all-star caliber players that the team had. And upon doing more research, I got to the Utah State like Hall of Fame website, and Mary Lou Ram was one of the top celebrities from Utah State, and the accolades that she had, you know, leading the team in strikeouts, ERAs, shutouts, most games played, consecutive games played, and just how great she actually was. And one thing that I found out from the Jane Worthington interview was that during the tournament, during the final, she managed to pitch, was it seven straight games? And of course, they said that's not really, you know, common. This age, a lot of players, you know, pitch half a game, if that. So hearing, you know, seven straight is actually pretty inspiring to some people. And I can only imagine being, you know, a part of a team that, you know, we all rely on this one player, and they just go and exceed the expectations by doing what she did. So
yeah, amazing. So it sounds like she was well known. She was a sports celebrity in USU.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
She was an All-American, and it's also interesting. I think the generational impact of this, because her daughter played at the University of Utah and is an Olympian, and again, kind of an All-American, celebrity player. So I don't know if it's training, learning to play from her mom when she's young, or genes, or both, or what it is. But definitely there's a long-term impact, a legacy for these early teams.
Yeah. So where would somebody like Mary Lou Ram go after they're not a professional softball league, is there? So after you graduate, you'd maybe get into coaching, or what would you do?
Anybody want to take this?
I'm not sure about Mary Lou Ram, actually. I don't know if Ethan would know more about, what her career was like after Utah State. I just know for Robin Petrini and Jane Worthington, they became coaches mm-hmm. after Utah State. They went to other schools.
Mm-hmm. That would be the way to stay involved if you
definitely,
want to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We're tallying. I think that's something we still need to do before our final presentation, is kind of figure out where most of the players ended up. Mm-hmm. But several of them became successful Division I coaches. Some of them became high school coaches. And I'm pretty sure Mary Lou Ram also coached.
Okay,
but I think maybe at the club level or the high school level, we'll need to check on that. Mm-hmm.
If you talk about football, say, there's the National Football League, of course, right? But not everybody on a college team is going to go to the NFL So most people are going to go to other mm-hmm. other parts, but they might stay involved, I suppose. But they might go to other professions.
There were actually prior to Title IX. This is kind of a back history. There were a number, in fact, a lot of professional teams nationwide. They started prior to World War II. They had big crowds, famous celebrities, people who traveled cross-country to play for the pro teams, and they were all corporate-sponsored. So examples would be, there was one called the Rayettes, which was a great name, sponsored by an asbestos company, but they won the national championship several times. The famous one in Utah is the Utah Shamrocks, and this, it's a funny history, because Title IX, in a sense, killed the professional softball leagues. It created opportunities for women to play in college, to get degrees, to also get scholarships, and the professional teams kind of faded away, I guess. I don't know. Ethan, do you want to say anything about Fern Gardner?
Yeah. So another celebrity that I researched was Fern Gardner. She attended Utah State and was like a four-sport athlete with softball, volleyball, basketball, and there's one more I'm spacing. I think track.
Or hockey, field hockey, one of the two.
Yeah, something like that. But she went on to play for the Utah Shamrocks. Great pitcher, phenomenal pitcher. But, like Professor Proctor said, it kind of fizzled out with Title IX, and that's when she kind of took the direction of coaching. And she came back to Utah State and managed to coach softball, volleyball, basketball, and was very successful at it. Had, X amount of wins every season, averaged about, 22 for depending on which sport it was. But, as we were doing the spectrum, I guess, archiving, the documents that we looked at were a lot of pictures of Fern Gardner with the team rosters that they had, and a lot of newspaper articles talking about, this is kind of the direction that she took. A lot of people were comparing her style of defense in women's basketball to, some of the greater ones. It was interesting. They're running a 1-3-1 defense, and they said it's not, this person from, Utah, or this person from BYU. It's Fern Gardner from Utah State, and I thought that was actually really cool.
That is cool. Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's take a brief break and we'll come back much more. We're talking with Tammy Proctor, USU Distinguished Professor of History, along with her students, Claire Rice, Ethan Jepson, Ethan Thompson, and Cecil Wilkinson. And we are talking about their class, sports history class, and a project, Sliding Into History, the legacy of USU women's softball champions 1980 to 1981. We'll have more following this. Thanks for listening to Access U Time. Tom Williams. We're talking about a project called Sliding Into History, the legacy of USU women's softball champions 1980 to 1981. This is being produced by students in Tammy Proctor's sports history class. So we're talking with Tammy Proctor, USU Distinguished Professor of History, along with her students, Claire Rice, Ethan Jepson, Ethan Thompson, and Cecil Wilkinson. I want to get into how you did this history, but before we do that, Tammy Proctor, I wonder if you'd tell me, finish up something that you said before the break about how this relates to Title IX. You said that Title IX essentially killed these professional softball leagues. Mm-hmm. So how do you put this in context, this all of this with Title IX?
Mm-hmm. So I think what's been interesting the last 3 years doing these sports projects is that there wasn't a pipeline for women to train as girls in the schools. We interviewed Lloydine Searle last year, who was the softball coach when they won here in 1981, and she said that she didn't have a softball program in her school at all. She didn't really want to play Little League Baseball, and so as a teenager, she actually trained with Fern Gardner, who was playing for the Utah Shamrocks, the professional team. And so these professional teams became almost like the minor leagues, in a sense. They had youth leagues that they would develop talent in. There were AAU amateur leagues for girls that often were played at local gyms. But it wasn't the same kind of pipeline that you see today. So there was this very robust professional and amateur club environment. When Title IX came around, suddenly there were scholarships on offer for student athletes. And that meant that many of the best and most talented people who would have gone to the pro teams ended up in college instead. And so I guess that's why I was saying that it kind of kills the pro teams. It also created a terrible problem in the 1970s, and we see this in the archives and with many people at USU, in that if you had played pro at all, if you'd earned even a dollar, you were ineligible for a scholarship under Title IX, under the AIAW, the women's league in the 70s. So there are these really heartfelt letters written to the national headquarters asking for reinstatement of amateur status, because sometimes it was only just like a corporate tournament where there was prize money, but it could disqualify you if you were considered to be at all pro. So the relationship between pro and amateur was really in flux in the 70s.
Mm-hmm. Of course, fast forward to today, you have name, image, likeness. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for some football players, they're earning millions. Mm-hmm. Of course, the average athlete is probably not earning that, but they're maybe earning some money.
Well, and when we were speaking with former athletes this week in oral histories, one of them mentioned that, you know, if you don't have a deal, you know, sponsorship deal, you don't get the money or the recognition, even if you've got, you know, TV audiences or in-person audiences. And she was comparing softball to, say, what's happening in women's basketball right now with the celebrity of people like, you know, Caitlin Clark.
Yeah, yeah. I want to talk just a bit. We'll get to some of the more research that you guys did. Clara, you mentioned you like watching Caitlin Clark, as we
yes.
all do, right?
Yes.
But is that just an appreciation, or does that relate to you? That, hey, if Caitlin Clark can do this, I can do some things.
You know, I am definitely not as good as Caitlin Clark in basketball, but I think it's just more of an appreciation because growing up, like, I didn't have many female athletes to look up to playing basketball. Same with my sister. She was more involved with basketball. And to look up to somebody like Caitlin Clark, like as a little girl right now, would be amazing. And she's just so popular because of social media, and all those women teams are being looked at right now. And I just wish that I had that when I was younger, to look up to somebody like that. And I did. I had people in the NBA that I looked up to and enjoyed watching the Utah Jazz and enjoyed watching, you know, Golden State Warriors, all those people. But, you know, it's really cool to see a woman out there being an idol and being somebody that these little girls can look up to and want to go play sports in. So that's why I appreciate it, yeah. Especially as a future educator. I'm like, that's
right.
Awesome.
Right.
So.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that is wonderful. And in some ways, I don't know, because of one and done and the rule for the NBA, you can just do your freshman year, right, on the men's side and go straight to the NBA.
Yeah.
In some ways, the women's game is funner to watch these days.
Yeah, I honestly would agree with that.
Yeah. I don't know if you gentlemen agree. Do you prefer the men's or the women's? That's a loaded question.
It is a loaded question.
Careful. Who wants
to take that bomb and run with it? Maybe the diplomatic answer is you like them equally.
That is correct.
Yeah. I do enjoy watching them.
I have watched both just because I did win the women's bracket, which was very fun to actually get invested in and very fun to watch both NCAA tournaments to actually get involved. And it was super fun to just watch them as an equal sport. I mean, as a viewer, it is so fun to just get invested. And then on top of that, just we see the different crowds in the women's team. They're so much more invested than the men's team, because I feel like sometimes the men's team would get so on their phones or they get lacklustered. But then with the women's team, they're all still in it. They're all cheering. They're all going. And it's super fun.
Yeah. You guys agree with that?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the research. You researched these national champion teams in 1980, 1981. So part of this was looking for historical artifacts. This was in the Spectrum. Spectrum, for those who don't know, is the basketball arena that seats, what is it, 10,000, 15,000, something like that. So it gets pretty rocking with some sports. So where'd you find these artifacts? Are these in the basement? Where do you find these?
We call it the dungeon here in Utah State.
Okay.
It's the Utah athletic system of just history. I mean, it was really awesome just to go to it. We had the awesome chance to go to, that during a class, and it was super fun because there was media guides, there were Sports Illustrated issues about just our sports, about Utah State sports especially, and even dating football team going to Japan. And it was super fun. But what was really interesting was finding the Utah State softball team stuff, which was always just so dusty because it's just such a knee sport at the time where they don't really care about it during the 70s and 80s. But now we care about it, so we want to find the resources. But for example, I found just a Title IX complaints of, I don't know, maybe like a couple hundred Title IX complaints from the 70s all the way up to the 90s, I want to say. But
What were these complaints? Were seeking what? Equal rights.
Yeah, just more along the lines.
Equal money.
Especially the funding, especially, was tremendous. The tremendous amount was the football team had so much money compared to any other sport. They even had dormitories for the football team, while the other sports had nothing. And this softball was right there with them. They probably, like, I don't know, in comparison, it's just a couple thousands to a couple hundred. And so back then, that meant a lot. And it was really fun to just see, but it was so dust covered that it was under thousands of books, and I randomly found that, which was really, really fun.
Yeah, yeah. This is part of history, I guess, Professor Proctor.
Yeah, I mean, part of the fun of history is, you know, discovery and finding things. And, and in this case, athletics has kept its own repository. It's not organized like an archive. It's, you know, it's a little bit haphazard, I'd say. And so we were looking to find things and digitize them so that both athletics and the library would have better access. And we also brought some acid-free folders so that we could move some of the materials into folders that would help protect them.
Yeah. The digitization, that's a great service, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then more people are...
It takes a long time, though. Actually, Claire could talk about this because she was digitizing.
Yeah, definitely. So down in the basement, there's just lines and lines and lines of filing cabinets, again, not in acid-free folders. So, like, a lot of the papers are, like, falling apart, and there's photos, and they sort of have it organized by years. There was a big stack that we found of all the women's softball files going back to, like, I think 70s up until, like, 89. So I had the opportunity to go through and scan each of those. We had this just little tiny scanner that I was going on and setting each photo and each piece of paper, scanning in stats, photos, like records. I even found like Robin Petrini's goals that she had set with her coach. And the one goal she said she wrote like, what did she write? She wrote win the national championship and that was it.
Ah.
And so that was really cool to see that and just to scan in. Yeah. But each one took like, you know, a couple minutes to scan in because it's a long process to do each and every photo and stats and all those different papers down there. So
those are some great finds. Yeah. Anybody else want to talk about what you found in the archives?
So me and the other Ethan, we were assigned with the, I guess, roster finding in multiple filing cabinets, just looking for names, looking for records, and, I mean, just anything we could get our hands on. I took the latter part of, I guess, the alphabet with, you know, Z, Y, X, W, whatever it is. And I found a lot of, you know, football players, basketball players, not so much as softball. I did find one softball, but it was only, you know, late 80s, and it was just a photo. But Professor Proctor called my name over, and or she called me over and said, we got a massive stack of Sports Illustrated, and it's almost like, you know, the heavens opened up. Because I was on cloud nine. I was like, okay, Sports Illustrated, like this could be awesome. So it stretched from like the early 60s to the late 70s, early 80s. And we were just looking for the one issue with was it Ferd and Gardner
that Aaron
was
in Logan, it? I think.
Yeah. And we were just looking for the one issue, the 1 week. And we did online research and we found the date. We found the cover picture. We said, okay, this is the one. We found the stack of the date range, and it was the only one that was missing. And for the first, you know, 15, 20 minutes, I'm there just swiping through Sports Illustrated pages, and I'm finding more ads for cigarettes than I am for for sports athletes. And I was like, this is awesome.
So, different time cigarette ads in the Sports Illustrated.
Yeah. I'm like, this is cool. I could get down with this.
Well, and especially because I don't know if you all remember when we were reading one of our books for the project, The Sports Revolution, that many of the early sponsors for women's sports were cigarette manufacturers. So the Virginia Slims tournament, for instance, the first major women's tennis tournament was sponsored by a cigarette manufacturer. So, you know. It's
makes sense.
Definitely tapping into the history. But,
I remember that name, and I had disassociated in my mind from cigarettes, but that's what it was, right? Virginia Slims was cigarettes, yes. So, Ethan, what can you tell us about what you found?
Yeah, so while the other Ethan was going to heaven, I was left to continue on my task of trying to find basically all the historical stuff that we could find in those folders of all those players. And honestly, it was just so cool. I kind of felt like Indiana Jones when I was going through there, just kind of like a historian, like archaeological kind of thing. It was so cool just like looking through a bunch of like dust covered, like just old things that like you wouldn't be able to find anywhere else, like basically in the world. I mean, it was just super cool. And just like going through and like finding like players from not even just like softball, but from like any sport that you could find, and going through and just kind of like taking a glimpse and looking at like what these random basketball or football players from like the 1930s like looked like and what their career like did. Those, I mean, something that like is kind of, I mean, it was kind of like a once in a lifetime kind of thing, at least for me. I genuinely enjoyed it so much. It was just like I said, so cool. Mm-hmm. And then giving them over to Claire so she could scan them.
Yeah, they're very good. Woo-hoo. Very good, yeah. By the way, random question, but at a certain point, the short shorts became longer shorts for men's basketball. I get all this period you're talking about, they still have the short shorts.
The
John Stockton.
Sure.
The John Stockton.
Yeah, yeah. You look at those early, even not so early, and you think, man, what were they thinking? Because it's all gone to, maybe gone the other way, baggy and, you know, extremely long now.
One thing that we found kind of interesting is a lot of the players talk about the uniforms, and it's also been in many of our readings, I think, but... you know, in the 70s, the women's teams and into the 80s, they were not supplied with full uniforms. And the uniforms they did have were, you know, variable in terms of their utility, I would say, for the sports that they were in. It's not as bad as some of the people we interviewed last year who said in the 60s that they had one set of uniforms that they rotated between sports.
Wow.
So... you wore the same uniform whether you were playing softball or basketball or whatever, which I find hard to believe.
Wow.
But, some of the people we interviewed suggested that they had to purchase a lot of their uniforms even into the 1980s, at least parts of their uniform.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and that goes to show just the budget on the teams. With that, that's just amazing to – just see the difference of how sports is, especially college sports, are treated so differently compared to like football.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We have somebody in our class who's kind of analyzing the budgets and creating spreadsheets to show, you know, some of the differences between the men's and the women's teams. But just anecdotally from the players we've talked to, they didn't have good travel accommodation. Robin Petrini was telling us that they shared four women. When they had a room, they shared four to a room, two to a bed. They used vans, which they drove themselves, which would never, like the players drove them. That would never happen. And what did she say about the vans?
She said that they would pack in the suitcases and then they'd sit on top of the suitcases and like sleep on them and stuff.
Wow.
While they were driving.
Yeah. She said no seatbelts whatsoever. So yeah. It was wild. It's kind of... it makes me grateful for, you know, all the equipment that I had growing up and stuff. And she even talks about when they went on a trip to Salt Lake as a team, her coach, they stopped to go buy batting gloves. And Robin was like, I thought I died and went to heaven because we got batting gloves, which is incredible for that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she also said they didn't have a sports facility on campus at the time. So the year they won, actually both years they won the national championship, they were playing on a city field in Smithfield. So to practice or to play games, they had to drive 30 minutes each way, basically. And they didn't have any kind of a field on campus until her senior year. And then she said it was a grass field between some dorms. We're not quite sure where it was. She was trying to describe it.
It was
to
up
us.
Somewhere up campus, up by like the old Mountain View Tower. Mm-hmm. Was what I'm thinking. The
maybe.
Tower apartments, maybe.
We're going to have to go looking
for
it.
We're going to look at that.
So, you know, you fast forward to today, there's still a huge disparity and probably growing between, you know, football is the sport that's, at least in some conferences where the money is just flowing in, sometimes basketball, right? But I don't know if that's being well, I know it's being distributed to other sports. I was listening to a sports talk program yesterday where the guy was talking about the SEC, which has huge money flowing in for football. He said now he's heard that the golf teams on some of those SEC schools are flying private. So some of that money is, I don't know, that's blowing to lacrosse or something, but it's at least getting down to golf. Well, that's SEC and the Big Ten, right? Other conferences like where USU plays is probably not the huge money. But still probably disparities, I'm guessing, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Well, we just hired two new basketball coaches for men's and women's basketball here, and I suspect if you were to line up their packages, you know, their salary and benefit packages, you would still see a disparity.
It's true. I think usually in each state, most states, the highest paid public employee is usually the football coach, exceeding the governor and everybody else, right? But anyway, let's take another break. We'll come back and do a little bit more of this history of USU softball. And talk about the 1980 and 1981 national champion USU softball teams, which Tammy Proctor and her students have been researching. More following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We've reached our final segment with USU history professor Tammy Proctor, and there's some of her students. They're working on a project called Sliding into History, the Legacy of USU Women's Softball Champions, 1980 to 1981. I want to get into legacy, but first, I don't know if somebody wants to respond to this question, which is what did this national championships, right? Did this make a noise? Did it make a dent? Was this team famous, semi-famous, ignored, at least at USU?
Well, I think at the time, a lot of women's sports weren't televised. So finding film footage of these games is quite difficult. And it's just 2 years before they moved to the NCAA because the women's teams were all under the AIAW until 1982-83. So I would say it was harder to get information about them nationally, but a lot of newspaper articles. But I don't know, maybe Cecil can talk about the Hall of Fame a little.
Yeah, of course. Just to go on to tie that in, it did make a little bit of a dent. We did have some local newspapers in the archives that we found about the 1980 to 1981 national championships. They just titled them back-to-back champions, but it was just one small little column. It wasn't even a front page. But it was just crazy to see how these national championship teams got credit, but they're only still a small little segment in even our Utah State Hall of Fame today. And it's crazy that we only have a paragraph of detail. These are players that strove really, really hard, even in competition, to with lower budget, with lower, not aspirations, but they had a bigger drive than most of the teams at Utah State to be back-to-back champions, which is an astounding feat. But on top of that, it was just every time I used to work as the Utah State delivery driver, I would go into the Hall of Fame a lot. And so even just seeing the teams, it would be just a picture and a couple of sentences. And it's these girls and women deserve to have a big poster right about them because they're back-to-back champions. And that many people can't say that they are.
Yeah, very well said. I just want to go around, talk about the legacy, what this means. Claire, what does this mean to you?
So I have some Aggie alum in my family. My great-grandfather actually was a football player, basketball player, and a track star at Utah State. And also my grandparents went here. And for me to have the opportunity to be a part of something where we're documenting history, and for me, like, it's very heartwarming. Like, I feel like I'm honoring my grandparents by doing this. And it makes me love Utah State even more. And I just want people to look at Utah State and see it as a school where they appreciate their past athletes and their athletes now. And I feel like we do have that. However, I think, you know, it's great that we have this class and that we're documenting it because it's very important. So that's just what it means to me.
Yeah, great. Ethan Jepson, what about you? What do you get out of this?
So kind of like Claire, I am a fourth generation Aggie, I think. Yeah, sorry. but yeah, so I mean, I've always grown up like in Logan, obviously, just wanting to like be an Aggie, do all the things that are involved in USU. And so to be able to like not hear about these for basically my entire life, like hear about these two like national championship level teams, like to go back to back and have never heard about anything involving that until taking this class. It's like kind of shocking. I mean, to think about like the fact that we have a total of three national championship teams and the only teams you ever hear about are the football and basketball teams, which quite frankly have never done like anything of any relevance compared to like these teams. It's just very shocking and very like interesting to go and like hear all this like history and like looking through all that, like I previously mentioned, like going through and doing like historical like research and like seeing all of this information that like would not have been found otherwise, like was just sitting collecting dust in the basement of the Spectrum waiting for someone to come and find out, like, all of these very, very talented players and, like, bring them back to the light again. And so I think it's just, as far as legacy goes, like, it's just really cool to be a part of that, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, very cool. We just have about a minute left, so about 30 seconds each. So, Ethan Thompson, what?
So, I guess in terms of, I guess what this means to me is, a few years ago when I was having my first semester at Utah State, I was coming here with, you know, my brother and my sister, and we kind of got on the topic of sports, and I was always curious to see how many, you know, national championships just Utah State collectively has. And I guess upon, you know, immediate thoughts, there wasn't many. But obviously, you know, as we learn more, as we kind of go through the dungeon, if you will, or just get down to the nitty gritty about all these sports and these athletes, we understand how many national championships we have, how great Utah State actually is. And seeing how that makes not just an immediate effect or immediate fact impact on the city, but how it can continually, you know, steamroll through generation. We see, you know, Caitlin Clark, we see all these other women who are, you know, competing at the highest level, who are getting accomplishments done, and to see, you know, just how much more can we find out about Utah State? How many more national championships did we win in various sports? Which athletes were, you know, notable? Like that kind of stuff. I think that's really what impacts me, is just how much more can we find out?
Yeah, very good. So we're just about out of time. I just have 15 seconds.
Yeah,
to you, Cecil.
No problem. Legacy means to me, it means that, like, it's never forgotten. Legacy is such a powerful term in my mind that it should be, like, close to a legend in my mind, and to be champions and not be told is kind of a black spot on Utah State. But I think it's we're finally bringing it to light, which is very well past its prime, but it's super, super awesome.
Well, yeah, thanks for bringing this to light. Thank you very much. So thanks to Tammy Proctor and for students in your class, Claire Rice, Ethan Jepson, Ethan Thompson, and Cecil Wilkinson. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks, everybody, for listening to Access Utah. We'll go out as we do on Wednesdays with Beehive Archive. Thanks.